It's 6 hours, what's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
A Sierra Leone district on lockdown over Ebola. The WHO puts the Ebola death toll at nearly 6,400. I'm Victor Beatty, reporting from Washington. Officials in Sierra Leone have imposed a two-week lockdown on the Eastern Diamond Mining District of Kono after 8 cases of Ebola were confirmed in one day. The lockdown announced Wednesday is expected to limit the movements of some 350,000 residents till December 23rd. According to the country's health ministry, there were more than 120 confirmed cases of the deadly virus recorded. The World Health Organization said investigators sent to the region last week found a grim scene of patients dying in a hospital ill-equipped to deal with the virus. The agency says Sierra Leone officials, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, and other organizations are sending staff and equipment to Kono. Earlier, the WHO said the overall death toll from Ebola is now nearly 6,400, with just under 18,000 total cases. WHO Director General Dr. Margaret Chan says Sierra Leone, Liberia, and Guinea are trying to combat the virus with inadequate healthcare systems.
Prior to the outbreaks, these countries had only 1 to 2 doctors to treat a population of nearly 100,000 people. That number has been diminished as more than 600 healthcare workers have been infected.
The WHO says Sierra Leone now has the highest number of reported cases at nearly 8,000, surpassing Liberia as the hardest hit nation in the region. Meanwhile, the U.S. news magazine Time has named its annual Person of the Year all of those who are engaged in fighting Ebola. Editor Nancy Gibbs said those doctors and nurses are willing to stand and fight in what she called a war. She said they're carrying out tireless acts of courage and mercy, risking their own lives while saving others. This is VOA News. Time magazine's editor said the medical workers have come from all over the world, including Doctors Without Borders and the Christian medical relief group Samaritan's Purse. The group's head, Franklin Graham, said these healthcare workers deserve this international recognition.
I'm thankful that they have put a spotlight back on Ebola, because these Ebola fighters are fighting right now. And Ebola is not over with. People are dying as we speak. So I'm just grateful that Time magazine put the spotlight on it, because it needs to be there. And these Ebola fighters are heroes. They really are. They put their life on the line, the army of young men and women that are fighting to save life.
Some of the workers have told Time magazine they see their own survival after catching the disease as a second chance to help others. Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe has appointed 2 new vice presidents as part of a general shakeup in the ruling ZANU-PF party. Justice Minister Emmerson Mnangagwa and former diplomat Pele Kezela Mfoko were named Zimbabwe's first and second vice presidents a day after the president fired his former deputy Joyce Mujuru. 68-year-old Mnangagwa has been closely allied with Mr. Mugabe since the country's war for independence in the 1970s. He's seen as a likely successor to the 90-year-old leader who has ruled Zimbabwe for 34 years. Nigeria's main opposition, the All Progressives Congress, is meeting in Lagos to choose a presidential candidate to challenge incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan of the ruling People's Democratic Party, seeking his own full term in February's election. Chris Stein reports.
5 candidates are in the running, but there are only 2 real frontrunners, says political analyst Chris Ngwodo. Former military ruler Muhammadu Buhari and former Vice President Atiku Abubakar have the best chance of securing the nomination of the party, which was formed last year as a coalition of the country's best-known opposition groups. Buhari and Abubakar both have long histories in Nigeria. They also have political baggage, which the PDP will use against them, Ngwodo says. Buhari commands support among people in Nigeria's north, but he's also lost several elections and is remembered by older generations as an authoritarian ruler who was booted out in a coup. Abubakar is seen as experienced and savvy when it comes to winning primaries, but Ngwodo says his checkered past, including his defection from the PDP, may be used against him. A decision from the APC is expected early Thursday morning. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
Voters in Mauritius cast ballots Wednesday in parliamentary elections, with rival parties promising to boost the economy and enhancing the debate on an expansion of presidential powers. The issue of constitutional reform has made the election one of the most important since independence achieved from Britain in 1968. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Peter Clotter in Washington, sitting in for the vacationing James Batty. Today is Thursday, December 11th, and here are some of these stories we are covering. Major Nigerian political parties choose their presidential candidate today ahead of next year's general election.
We are waiting who the APC is going to elect as the flag bearer, given the profile, the political credentials of all the five presidential aspirants within the party.
Kabiru Matu is political science professor at the University of Abuja. Analysts say Boko Haram's use of female suicide bombers in strikes across the country show its growing ambition. And Cameroon's main opposition leader is scheduled to hold a news conference today about a new anti-terrorism measure approved by Parliament.
Any aspect of the law which is there to fight terrorism, we are for that, because nobody can be indifferent to the suffering of people all over the world, including and especially in the northern part of Cameroon.
That's parliamentarian Joseph Bandazem of the opposition Social Democratic Front. A rights group in Mali is unhappy about a deal that set free a hostage held by Al-Qaeda's North Africa branch. And the capital of Jonglei State in South Sudan held an event where officials emphasized the suffering of victims from the year-long violence. Those stories, plus Marco Ume's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's main opposition All Progressive Congress, APC, is set to choose its presidential candidate, while incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan would also be confirmed by the ruling People's Democratic Party, PDP, today, Thursday. The ruling PDP is holding its party convention in the capital, Abuja, and the main opposition, APC, is holding its congress in the commercial capital, Lagos. Kabiru Matu, professor of political science at the University of Abuja, told me that prospective Nigerian voters seem excited about the outcome of the conventions in the run-up to next year's general election.
Nigerians really are enthusiastic. They are anxious. They want to know especially who is the candidate of the main opposition party. The People's Democratic Party that is holding government in Nigeria today and that has held power since the return to civil rule in 1991, has already made it abundantly clear that President Jonathan is running. And we are waiting who the APC is going to elect as its flag bearer, given the profile, the political credentials of all the five presidential aspirants within the party. So the Nigerians are really very excited. We are anxious. We want to know what is there. And perhaps it's only after the election is conducted in Lagos that we'll be able to know who is going to stand the election.
Professor Matu, the PDP has fired its first salvo, saying in the newspapers that they are ready to debate competence and the abilities of the each candidate after the APC decides on its candidate for the presidential election next year. What is your take on that?
Well, I think that's to me, a very mere flat political statement, because in 2011, we saw very clearly that it was only President Jonathan among all the presidential aspirants that failed to appear before Nigerians at various organized debates in order to be able to explain to the citizenry on what they have. But yes, they said so. And I really don't know. I will not like to preempt the situation.
What are you hearing about the ability of the Independent Electoral Commission, or INEC, to administer this year's election based on reports that new constituencies have been created, biometric system is going to be used for the elections next year? How are people reposing confidence in the ability of INEC to administer a credible vote, if I may ask you?
Well, you see, on a general note, I think what you are saying, Peter, is right. There is this apprehension. And the apprehension is basically born out of the fact that the history, the track record of the Electoral Commission in the previous elections has not been anything very encouraging. But as far as I'm concerned, I have tremendous confidence on the integrity of the INEC leadership at the center. And I also believe in the sincerity that they desire to conduct a free and fair election. But as you know, the major problem here is not necessarily on how prepared INEC is. is not also necessarily anchored on the fact that the independent commission is doing everything possible to do a free, fair, and credible election. But it also has to do with the fact that the political class, from no matter what political party, go into elections in Nigeria with a lot of permutations.
Kabir Mato is professor of political science at the University of Abuja. He spoke with me from Nigeria's capital. In its five-year campaign to establish a caliphate in Nigeria, extremist group Boko Haram has repeatedly used suicide bombers against civilians and the military. But analysts say its recent use of female suicide bombers in strikes across the country show its growing ambition. Chris Stein reports from Abuja.
The bombing of a market in the northeastern Nigerian city of Maiduguri last month bore all the hallmarks of an attack by Boko Haram. The group has struck Maiduguri repeatedly, but this bombing, which killed more than 30 people, was different. The two bombers were women. Boko Haram has recently been sending women to carry out suicide bombings across Nigeria, particularly in the northeast, but also as far away as the country's largest city, Lagos. No one is quite sure why they have started using women, but a member of the Nigeria Security Network, Elizabeth Pearson, who is a doctoral student at King's College London, says the bombings are a sign of the group's strength.
So this has been a very ambitious year for Boko Haram, and I think that the use of the female suicide bombers, if anything, points to this ambition. Because the reason that Boko Haram needs more recruits is not because they are necessarily beleaguered by the strength of the government opposition to them. It's because they are ramping up the ambition in the northeast, ahead of the elections, with this attempt to establish a caliphate.
Pearson says Boko Haram deploying female bombers is a shift away from the more traditional role of women in their campaign.
Mainly women are seen to have a supportive role. They should be encouraging jihad, they should be encouraging men, they can be propagandists, they can really sell the narrative, but they shouldn't really be involved in fighting. And Boko Haram has adhered to that to some degree. But I think where it's become strategically useful, they are obviously willing to subvert that.
There has been speculation some bombers might be drawn from the ranks of more than 200 schoolgirls the group kidnapped earlier this year from the northeastern town of Chibok. But Pearson says there has been no proof of that. Jamestown Foundation African Affairs analyst Jacob Zen says the group has likely drawn on women as a matter of convenience and as a psychological tactic. Now anyone could be a potential bomber.
So it heightens the fear of their capabilities. And you also have to understand that there's, you know, widows of Boko Haram members. And this allows Boko Haram to utilize these leftover women in their network that otherwise might not be able to serve a purpose.
Zen says Boko Haram uses a range of methods to convince suicide bombers. Women may have their children threatened, be brainwashed, or be strapped with remotely detonated bombs.
They're engaged in a war against their enemies, defined as Christians or Muslims who don't follow them, who don't subscribe to their beliefs. And they will use any means possible without regard to conventional morality to achieve their aims. So whether it's a 6-year-old girl or a 8-year-old girl or a man that is disabled, they will use any of those means to carry out their attacks. This is, in my view, completely consistent with their operational style.
Regardless of who the bombers are, the continued ability to strike across Nigeria shows Boko Haram's determination to make their goal of creating a caliphate in northeastern Nigeria a reality. Chris Stein for VOA News, Abuja.
A leading member of Cameroon's parliament says a newly passed anti-terrorism bill could easily be misused to undermine the country's constitution. Joseph Banda Zem of the main opposition Social Democratic Front says President Paul Biya's government could employ the measure to crack down on dissent and muzzle the media. The SDF argues that the measure could plunge the country into public disorder and heighten tension. Banda Zem told me that SDF leader John Fruh Indi would hold a news conference today to warn Mr. Biya not to sign the anti-terrorism measure into law. Joseph Banda Zem is parliamentary leader of the main opposition Social Democratic Front, SDF. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé.
It looks like the text is coming to cut down on the press, on the civil society, on political parties. And they are mixing it up, but we are stating our facts very, very clearly that We are for laws that are meant to fight terrorism. Any aspect of the law which is there to fight terrorism, we are for that, because nobody can be indifferent to the sufferings of people all over the world, including and especially in the northern part of Cameroon. That what government is sliding in order to crack down on the press, on the opposition parties, on civil society, that is what we are fighting against. That's what we are warning government against.
But some supporters of the ruling party are saying that this is what the president was voted for, to protect unarmed civilians and to protect the life and property of Cameroonians. So the criticisms about this new measure is misplaced. What do you say about that?
Well, that's what they are saying. If you listen to what government was saying yesterday, let me just take, for instance, the press. What the government spokesman yesterday was saying, the pressmen were saying to government, are you telling us that whenever we have whatever information, we bring it to you before we publish it? He says, and if we do not bring it, it is punishable according to that law, death, and so on. So you find out that government is trying to portray a wrong impression, a wrong image of the opposition and the entire Cameroon people, because they are not only struggling to fight terrorism, they are putting in other sections of the law which is meant to crack on the people.
The president could soon sign this new measure that was passed in Parliament on Wednesday. That means that it will become law very soon. What is your next line of action about this measure that you are opposed to?
In fact, today there was a civil society, you call it in French, Dynamique Citoyenne, which demonstrated in town so that the head of state should not promulgate it. Tomorrow, the national chairman of my party is going to have a press conference to explain why the president has a second reading and define what he means by terrorism and move out sections that are bent and geared towards the population. So there is some sort of action that is not very, very concrete.
Joseph Bandazem is parliamentary leader of the main opposition Social Democratic Front, SDF. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Peter Clotta in Washington. Today is Thursday, December 11th. Please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Ahead on our program, Mark Holman Sport and our listener of the day. A rights group in Mali says it is alarmed by the apparent deal that set free the last French hostage held by Al-Qaeda's North Africa branch. Four accused terrorists were released in Bamako in the days before the release of a French citizen. Katrina Hoya reports from Bamako.
On Tuesday, France declared that the country's last remaining hostage in the hands of Al-Qaeda was on his way home. Serge Lazarevich spent nearly 3 years as a captive of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Akim. Just days before, two young Malians from the northern city of Kidal, along with the Western Sahara men and a Tunisian, were released from prison in Bamako. The two Malians, arrested in 2011, were suspects in the kidnapping of Lazarevich. The two are close to Yad Agali, the leader of Ansadin, an Islamist group with links to Akim. Drissa Traoré with the human rights organization AMDH, Association Malienne des Droits de l'Homme, is troubled by the apparent swap.
Nous sommes choqués parce que tout simplement nous pensons que cette libération est une violation flagrante.
The liberation is a violation of the rights of the victims, but also of the principles that say the government should not interfere with the work of the judiciary, Traoré says. The Tunisian and Western Sahara men were released from the central prison in Bamako on December 4th. 2 days later, the two Malian prisoners were transferred from Bamako's central prison to a location in northern Mali. In Niger, the hostage mediator, a prominent Tuareg, Mohamed Akote, awaited Lazarevich's release. Traoré says the four former prisoners were all guilty of war crimes.
On libère des criminels de guerre.
They are terrorists capable of abducting Westerners and holding them for ransom, he says. They are a danger both to foreigners in Mali and Malians. It's almost like the life of one foreigner is worth more than the life of 15.9 million Malians, Traoré says. The two Malians, Mohamed Ali Ag Wadhuseni and Haiba Ag Asharif, are the main suspects for the kidnapping of Lazarevich and another French citizen, Philippe Verdon, in Hombori in northern Mali in November 2011. Verdon was found shot dead in 2013. In June this year, Wadhuseni had escaped from the central prison in Bamako, killing one prison guard.
Française. Même si, d'une part, nous sommes d'accord et d'ailleurs nous saluons la libération de Serge Lazarevich parce qu'il vient de recouvrir quand même la liberté.
Traoré says he's happy for the release of Lazarevich, but says the price was Mali security, as the four criminals are a threat to our country and abroad. There's no doubt. Traoré says that the four men will rejoin the armed groups.
Ils vont grossir les rangs des groupes armés parce qu'ils vont rejoindre ces groupes armés.
This allows them to increase their strength, Traoré says. The Malian Association for Human Rights is urging Mali's government and international organizations to work towards re-arresting the four men as soon as possible. Analysts in Mali says it is highly likely a ransom was also paid, giving Hakim or affiliated groups a sizable sum of money, but there is no confirmation. The presence of international troops in northern Mali has limited the area where Hakim can operate in recent years. The group is weaker now than when it took control of urban centers in the north in 2012. Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb has suffered losses fighting mainly French forces. A military analyst in Bamako says the group's use of improvised explosive devices, basically homemade bombs on roads, shows it is not strong enough to launch an attack and wants to avoid direct confrontation. Katerina Höye for VOA News in Bamako.
The capital of Jonglei State held its own event marking World Human Rights Day in Bo, where officials emphasized the continued suffering of victims from South Sudan's year-long violence. UNMISS officials say one thing Jonglei State officials can do to improve the human rights situation in its state is to focus on educating children. Jacob Achik has this report for VOA from Bo.
Many of the 100 of Jonglei State citizens attending today's celebration expressing their fervent hope that human rights violation will end one peace finally return to South Sudan. The Jonglei State's Minister of Cabinet Affairs, Samuel Jong Bang, says acknowledging and protecting human rights is the duty of everyone, including the international community.
The basic rights include the right to live, rights for the liberty, rights for the marriage, right for the ownership of property, rights for education and others. In this day, people of South Sudan and Jonglei State particularly, we are celebrating and want to acknowledge that these are important rights which are subjugated by our laws. And the government is working very hard to protect them and to grant for everyone a right so that our citizens live in peace, practice their lives the way they want.
Maya Mungong, a member of parliament in Jonglei State Assembly, says if there are people in Jonglei State, human rights exist. He said the diversity of the crowd attending today's celebration is proof that the people of South Sudan can live together in peace.
We thank the UNMISS that they should be with us and always followed the peace being discussed in Addis Ababa, that the people will bring peace among themselves as we are now staying here. We are from different nationalities, and we sit together. That is showing us that we are respecting human rights.
Ngong said although some areas in Jonglei State are still being controlled by anti-government forces, government officials will coordinate separate peace and human rights conference to ensure that peace is achieved in the state. UNMISS Jonglei State's coordinator Adel Dewitt says South Sudan is a young country. Not only it is newest country in the world, but the vast majority of its people are under the age of 30s. For Jonglei State, this means that supporting quality education will be a critical strategy for maintaining peace and reducing human rights abuse.
I would want for us all, in particular the government, to rededicate our interest in the interest of education for South Sudan, in the interest for education for the girl child, in the interest for young girls to be able to complete their education before being considered for marriage.
The word said all young children must be able to access school and complete their educations and adiban in order to lead South Sudan into the 22nd sanctuary. Jonglei State officials said they will commit themselves to restoring peace in the state so that each and every citizen can feel that their right will not be abused. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Echek in Bor.
It's now time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good Thursday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Peter. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Oceania champions Auckland City of New Zealand pipped Morocco's Maghreb Tetouan 4-3 in a post-match penalty shootout in the opening encounter of the FIFA Club World Cup in Rabat, Morocco on Wednesday. Auckland City has played in a record 6 appearances in this competition and now advanced to the quarterfinals. In handball, Kenya Defence Force beat Kenya's National Cereal and Produce Board 31-26. In the men's contest at the Eastern Central Africa Handball Club Championships in Nairobi, Kenya on Wednesday, Uganda Prisons dismissed Kenya's University of Nairobi 39-27. Meanwhile, the winner in the women's contest will be determined in an all-Kenyan encounter between Nairobi Water Queens and National Cereals and Produce Board, as the Democratic Republic of Congo's police, who are defending champions, did not pitch for this year's contest. In Olympic news, Tunisian Meriem Cherni Mizouni received the International Olympic Committee's Women and Sports World Trophy in Monaco. She was the first Tunisian female Olympian in 1976. The accolade is in recognition of her contribution to the promotion of women in sports in Tunisia. Staying in Monaco, Egypt's Aya Mahmoud Medani received the International Olympic Committee's Trophy for Africa. She is a three-time Olympian in modern pentathlon, having first competed at the Olympics at the tender age of 15. Upon retiring, she has made a significant contribution towards the introduction of biathlon in Egyptian schools and worked to raise funds for equipment to enable women and girls participate in sports while also pursuing their formal education. Turning to cricket, defending champions Uganda beat Kenya by 50 runs to retain the Africa Women's Under-19 2020 Championship Trophy in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Uganda has won the title for a fifth consecutive year. Hosts Tanzania placed third and are followed by Botswana, Rwanda and Mozambique in that order. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, Peter, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Yes, our listener mail for this Thursday morning, December 11th.
I call on the Human Rights Commission as a matter of urgency to find a lasting solution or solutions to domestic violence, which is so rampant these days. I don't know whether it is the economic problem that is austerity measure or ignorance or superstition that is increasing the violence is getting out of proportion before it will turn to another thing in our country. Comrade Mazi Patrick Okuro Crawford, Home of the Witnesses, Atani Archibald in Abia State, Nigeria.
Thank you, listener, for your comment. Please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's it for this Thursday, December 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporter Ricky Shryok, as well as sports editor Mark Ouma, and Peter Clotte in Washington, wish you all a good Thursday.
Next on Let's Talk, hairstyles in Africa. Hairstyles in Africa is a topic we'll discuss in a new lighthearted show, Let's Talk. So join me, Sandeep Shamari, and my guests as we explore hairstyles in Africa with some hilarity. That's Let's Talk, Monday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.